Hello and welcome to Networking Unleashed, Building Profitable Connections. Welcome back to the show, folks. I'm your host, Michael Foreman, and you're listening to the podcast where networking is more than just awkward handshakes and bad coffee. It's an art and a talent. But here's the twist. It's an art and talent you can actually learn. Yes, even if you're the person hiding in a corner at every event pretending to check emails. Networking isn't just a nice skill to have, it's a game changer. And when you get good at it, you'll wonder why you didn't start sooner. More connections, more opportunities, more profits. It's like unlocking a cheat code for life. So whether you're the life of the party or just the let me stay at home and text type, I've got something for you. So stick around and let's turn those awkward small talk moments into big wins. I've got an incredible guest today. His name is Frank King. Let's say he's been around the horn a little bit and he has quite an extensive background. But let me just tell you that Frank King is a corporate comedian, TEDx speaker, and a suicide prevention advocate with over 20 years of experience as a writer for The Tonight Show. So before I butcher his background, I really just want to introduce Frank and let him tell you a little bit more about it. Frank, how are you today?
Enjoying a wonderful cup of coffee.
Right.
I'm good. And I've been around the horn twice, actually. The horn. First
The
time
horn.
around, the weather was gorgeous. The sea was flat like a pool table. I do stand-up comedy on cruise ships. I've been to all seven continents, including Antarctica, twice. And we were on our way to Antarctica. And I come up on deck, I look, and it's just a gorgeous day. And I said, "What's that big rock?" to one of the pastors. He goes, "Frank, that's the horn." I go, "It can't be. I've seen pictures of this area when I was a kid. Giant waves, sea serpents, ships flipping over, guys falling out. This could be." But it was. The second I went around, it was like that. The ship didn't turn over, but it was ugly.
Yeah.
I started comedy in the fourth grade, 9 years old. Actually, people often ask me, "Were you born funny?" Yes, as a matter of fact, an amusing thing happened on the way down the birth canal. But I was born funny. Ninth grade, I told a joke. Kids laughed. Teacher was hysterical. So hysterical, she had to excuse herself to go to the teacher's lounge. She was laughing so hard. I realized at that moment I was going to be a comedian. 12th grade, I've been taking drama for 3 years, never got a speaking part. Spring, they had a talent show. And I thought, you know what? If I do stand up, I can write, direct, produce, star my own little show every night. I'm going to do stand up. Nobody had ever done stand up at the talent show. And there's a picture of me in the annual in a really ugly three-piece suit holding the microphone and doing my stand-up. And I won. Of course, I beat the accordion player and the folk dancer, so not a huge victory, but still a victory.
Victory.
Went home, told my mama, "I'm going to LA." She goes, "No, son, you're not. You are going to college first. I don't care what you do when you get done. You can be a goat herder for all I care. You're going to be a goat herder with a college degree." So UNC Chapel Hill, picked up a couple of college degrees, neither of which I've ever used, but I graduated and then bolted for the West Coast. And 40 years ago, this coming April 1st, I was doing my first open mic night, and inside my head, about halfway through, I heard a voice, "You're home." Decided at that moment I would do it for a living. Had no idea how. Matter of fact, Michael, I've threatened for years to write a keynote called "What could you do if you didn't know no better?" Because had I known how hard it was to make a living doing stand-up, I might not have tried. 18 months later, said to my girlfriend, now my wife of 37 years, "I'm going on the road to be a comic full-time. You want to come along for the ride?" Figuring she'd go, "Oh, hell no." She goes, "Yeah." So we gave up the apartment and our jobs, jumped into my tiny Dodge Colt, and we were on the road for 2,629 nights in a row, nonstop. Club to club, beer bar to beer bar, pool hall to pool hall, drunk idiots screaming, "Tell us some jokes we can dance to. Here comes a slow one, you can slow dance." And 7 years and change. And then came off the road to do radio in my old hometown of Raleigh, North Carolina. Got a job on the morning show, the number one morning show in Raleigh, North Carolina. And in 18 months, I drove it to number six. A friend of mine said, "You didn't drive that into the ground, you drove it into Middle Earth." I did. And then I made the jump to corporate comedy because the clubs are closing faster than they were opening. People ask me, what's the difference between a club comic and a corporate comic? About $5,000 a night plus travel. Yeah, I'm no math major, Michael, but that made sense. Some of my really pure comic purists friends, you sold out, you went corporate. Yes, I did. I'm a prostitute, but I'm a high-paid prostitute.
That's right.
Did that till 2008 when the bottom dropped out of the speaking slash comedy market with the recession. Lost everything in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. That's when I learned what the barrel of my gun tasted like. Spoiler alert, I did not pull the trigger. When speaking came back, meeting planner said to me, Frank, we love you. Can't pay you 5 grand anymore just to be funny. You have got to teach the audience something. I had no idea what to teach. But a friend of mine, Judy Carter, wrote a book called The Message of You: Turn Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. She gave me a copy. She goes, Frank, you read this, you'll figure it out. And she takes you by the hand and walks you through the process. Halfway through, I thought, I do have something to talk about. Given my near suicide, two mental illnesses, the fact, Michael, there are more nuts in my family than in a squirrel turd, I could keen out on suicide prevention if I got some training, which I did. Then I thought, now wait a minute. I've been doing comedy for 2.5 decades. Who's going to take me serious about anything? So my wife said famously, do a TEDx. And I said famously, what's a TEDx? As I get ready to do my 13th TEDx, I got an application that week from a TEDx in Vancouver, BC. And so I applied, I auditioned, I got it. And then two more events called and said, do you have any more mental health topics? Yes, I do. Those are my first three. So I proved to people that I could do something deadly serious, literally deadly serious, with humor, funny personal anecdotes, not jokes, but anecdotes. And by the way, there's a rule in comedy, Michael. You can make fun of any group to which you belong. And having two mental illnesses and coming close to killing myself, I am doubly qualified. So that's the long and the short. And I've been doing that. I had other speeches. I had a networking speech, as a matter of fact. I have a networking speech that'll make you cry. It's a story about networking. It's about how I networked to help someone out. And at the end, I said, look, if I don't ever do anything good for anybody else in my lifetime, that story right there should get me into heaven. But I decided January 1st, 2018, I'm just going to be a suicide prevention speaker. Because Jane Atkinson, wealthy speaker coach, said, pick a lane, be the expert or thought leader. Just do one thing and figure out who needs that thing and is willing to pay you for it. So I thought, okay, I'm a suicide prevention speaker. And then I've been doing that since 2018.
I'll tell you from my experience as a speaker, that was always the case. Pick a lane, go to it, and you'll do wonders. It's worked so far. And hearing it from you with your vast experience tells me that I was given the right advice. Okay, so I'm going to go right into the questions. How has networking played a role in your mission to raise awareness about suicide prevention?
I'm a big believer in giving value first without expectation of return. My mother taught me that. I didn't know she was teaching me that. She loved to network, although we didn't call it that at the time. People would call her all hours, day and night, and ask if they could get some help from her. And if she could help, she would do her best to help them. And I'm watching this as a child, and to no benefit of her own, just because she knew somebody who could probably get it done, and she took great pleasure in getting it done. And so I have networked with other entertainers, other speakers in my career, and I think that's the key, a key to success is the network. It's a lonely business as a speaker, as a comedian, you're doing it by yourself. So I believe you have to build a network. And I believe when you network, it's like a garden. You have to tend it. You have to nurture it. I'm still in touch with my 8th grade history teacher. M was Miss Hill, now Mrs. Godey. And I needed something. I needed somebody called me, a fraternity brother of mine, had a daughter who graduated from college, and she wanted to work in a school where they worked with autistic kids. And I said to him what my mother would say, I'll see what I can do. So I called Ms. Godey, who had been a teacher in Raleigh, North Carolina, and on the Wake County School Board, and said, listen, here's the deal. She graduated college. She's really bright. She wants to work. And so We helped a networker into a job in Cary, North Carolina, at one of the top schools for autistic kids in the South. So that's eighth grade teacher.
Your network goes way, way back.
Yes, and the greatest thing I've ever done, networking wise, was I was taking a martial arts class on Whidbey Island, Washington, and had a fellow student, Elise. And Elise came in crying one day. And I said, "What's wrong?" She said, "We're trying to adopt a child from Nepal. My husband's there now. It's the last visa he will have because we can't afford to send him back again." And I said, "What's holding up the audition?" She said, "Well, the birth mother signed off, the birth father signed off, the Nepalese government signed off. What's the catch?" "Homeland Security." I said, "Look, I've never had a 3-year-old, but I can't believe he's that big a terrorist." So before I could stop myself, Michael, I said exactly what my mother would say. "I'll see what I can do." And I believe there's power in giving voice to that. Because as I'm driving home, I'm thinking, I'm a comic on Whidbey Island. How do I impact international relations to politics? And then it occurred to me, there was a guy in Raleigh that went to junior high school a year or two ahead of me named Tom Fetzer. And then he became mayor of Raleigh. He was mayor of Raleigh when I was there working for the radio station. So we got reacquainted at the YMCA. And so Tom is a Republican operative. He worked for, oh good, Strom Thurmond and Jesse Helms. But and the thing was that this is during the George W. Bush administration. So pretty much everybody in town is a Republican. And this woman, Elise, was connected with the two senators and the governor in Washington State, but they're Democrats. So that was where she's getting jammed up. So I called Tom. I said, "Tom," I told him a story. He said, "This is my mother would say, I'll see what I can do." Now, Tom and I agree on nothing political, nothing. But we agree on humans and kids. So Tom said, "I'll see what I can do." So that was Tuesday. On Thursday, I got a call back from him. I said, "How'd it go?" He said, "Frank, I called Elizabeth Dole, who was a senator in North Carolina at that time, Liddy Dole. And I told her the situation. And she called Homeland Security. And what happened at Homeland Security?" And he said, "Frank," and I'm quoting, "I tore him a new asshole," end quote. And so the word went out from Washington, D.C., in a diplomatic pouch to Nepal to say, "Cut the kid loose." See, but I don't know. I go back to class on Monday morning and Elise is not there. And I'm thinking, oh man, it didn't work. Tuesday, no Elise. Oh, I can't believe we got so close. Tuesday, I go to the grocery store after class. I'm pushing my little buggy. I come around the corner. There stands Elise holding the hand of a darling little 3-year-old child. I'm crying. She's crying. His name is Avi. Avi looks me in the eye and goes, "Avi, go pee." I said, "Yes, and on American soil, I might add." So I don't know if it's possible to have that kind of impact on three people's lives very often in a lifetime. So if I never do anything good again, the fact that I helped to bring them together to pull that off across the international dateline. And Tom Fetzer, who we agree on nothing politically, but he did it because he could do it. I did it because I thought I could do it. And Liddy Dole apparently likes kids and likes Tom. And there we go.
You're at the right place at the right time, you knew the right people, and you never even knew it.
And I couldn't stop myself from saying, "I'll see what I can do." Oh dear God, did I say that out loud?
Yeah, you know what? It's ingrained in your system,
It is.
because your first thought is to help somebody.
Yeah.
And so what comes out is what your mother said. So it goes a long way. It really does. And you can never be faulted for doing the right thing. You can be, but that's beside the point.
Yeah.
But at least you tried. Except this time you tried and something came out of it. It's a beautiful thing. It really is. What advice do you have for professionals who want to build meaningful connections that foster mental well-being in their networks?
A, what I learned from my mom was when you meet someone, don't think about what they can do for you. Focus on what you can do for them. A lot of people make that mistake networking. They pass out business cards, they're hustling, they're trying to figure out what the person they're talking to can do for them. Again, I believe you figure out what you can do for them without expectation of return. And Zig Ziglar famously said something on the order of help enough people get what they want, and there's a good chance you'll get what you want. And I'm a
Absolutely. And
big believer.
that's one of the main things that I talk about when I go, when I speak. So you have to go into that situation. What can you give? Don't think about receiving. When you're meeting with somebody, you say, how can I make you more successful? Or how can I be a good referral source for you without even thinking what it can do for me? So that's a very good. So we're right on line with this, the same thing. How did you leverage networking to land your TED Talk, and what tips do you have for others looking to do the same?
I can't swear that I used my networking as a leverage to get the TEDx.
Okay.
It's a very simple process. You apply, you audition, you get it. And there was no one I didn't have anybody in the TED world that I could use, that I could contact and say, hey, listen, can you help me? Although I coach TEDx. We have a program called the TEDx Launchpad. And the first half an hour is always free. Now, obviously, I want to sell them the program. But oftentimes, we realize very quickly that they don't have the money, even to finance it. We have financing. But I don't cut the call short because they don't have the money. What I do is I say, look, here's the deal. You want to be a speaker? Yes. You want to do a TEDx? Yes. Okay. Here's how you get started very inexpensively. Buy Judy Carter's book, The Message of You, figures under 20 bucks. Buy Talk Like TED by Carmine Gallo. It's a great TEDx 101. Again, under 20 bucks. I can get you started down the path to be a professional speaker and have a TEDx talk if you just buy those two books. Now, that said, when you start putting yourself out as a speaker, I would recommend you, if they ask your fee, $5,000 plus travel. That's a starting point nowadays. B, when you're filling out the TEDx application, pro tip, some of them say, who do you want to nominate? It's a way, I believe, of them cutting down the number of people who fill them out because you're thinking, who's going to nominate me? Here's what they don't tell you. You can nominate yourself, which they don't tell you. So I try to give them tips and tricks and things for free that will ease, that will speed their journey, even though they can't afford, it's obvious they can't afford. And I have some other pro tips on when you go to audition, make sure you have. They're going to go, great idea. Now, what are you going to teach the audience? Make sure you have learning objectives, figured out. And then they're going to ask you, great, what's the takeaway? So make sure you have takeaways figured out. Because I had a speaker call me one day. He'd gotten an audition and got blown out. And I said, how'd you get blown out? He goes, Frank, they asked me for my learning objectives. What's a learning objective? I'm thinking, how long have you been speaking? So yeah, so I give them tips that they, for 40 bucks, they can do all that on their own. And not use me. And it's no to no benefit of mine. Maybe they might, if somebody else, they ask me what they can do for me. If somebody says, I want to do a TEDx or I want to make money speaking or I want to do both, just say, I know a guy.
Absolutely. And which I happen to have you in my little knapsack also, because you're the first name that comes off my lips if somebody asks me that question.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're right there. Okay. So what's the most impactful connection you've made through public speaking, and how did it change your career?
Let's see. The most impactful was personally was the one I told you. Oh, I know.
Okay.
The I took a class, an 8-hour class on mental health, no, suicide prevention in the workplace from Dr. Sally Spencer Thomas. And she lost her brother to suicide. And she's a psychologist. And she is big deal. She's a big deal in the world of suicide prevention. And she has a friend named Sarah Gare, who's a therapist who teaches suicide prevention to first responders. So they're friends. I didn't know Sarah, but I met Sally. I did the class. She had a fundraiser. I'm an auctioneer as well. So I just charged her for my travel and I went and did the auction. It was in an airplane hangar in Colorado in the summer. I was sweating like George Bush at a spelling bee. It was horrible. I did it for travel. So Sarah teaches first responders about suicide prevention, and most of them are men. She wanted to buy a book on men's mental health for one of her students. She went to Barnes and Noble, brick and mortar store, nothing. Amazon, nothing. She thought, well, there's a vacuum. So she contacted Sally, said, I've got an idea. So Sally thought it was a great idea. They contacted me because Sally knew me. She said, Frank, listen, here's the idea. And we want to make it funny. Would you make the book funny? I said, wait a minute. You two ladies are writing a book on men's mental health. Don't you think you might need a co-author who is, I don't know, a man? A man. I said, here's the deal. I'll make it funny if I can be a co-author and I can record the books for Audible, narrate them. So no money for me besides a third of whatever profit we make on the books. And I haven't seen a dime yet, and that was years ago. But that was the best connection because Sally and Sarah are, and I helped Sarah get a TEDx talk, two of them, as a matter of fact. Didn't charge her a dime. So it's, and Sally already had a TEDx, so I wasn't able to, but that probably right there. And by the way, I have never seen a psychologist, psychiatrist, or therapist. I'd never been officially diagnosed until we were working on book one, and I described my symptoms to Sally and Sarah, and they said, you have major depressive disorder and chronic suicidal ideation. So they diagnosed me, and they were absolutely right. But again, I took Sally's class. I did the auctioneering for travel with no expectation of anything else. And lo and behold, they called me. And now it was going to be one book, an anthology, 12 guys, each one has a problem. Life's good, life's bad. Here's how I'm coping. And we figured if we get 12 guys to be honest about their issues, we'd be lucky. We got 60 guys. So it became four books. So I am a best-selling author on Amazon four times over. Now, I was a best-selling author on the day they went up. It didn't last very long. Somebody said to me, how long are you going to call yourself a best-selling author? Until the day I die.
That's right.
Because I am. I have four
Yep.
best-selling books on Amazon, thanks to networking with Sally with Sarah, and that's probably the most impactful.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Okay, let's move the needle a little bit. How does humor help break down barriers and create stronger connections in professional networking?
It's not just professional events, pretty much anywhere. It's disarming. And it to make people laugh, you have to make a connection. They have to be seeing the world the way you see it to make them laugh. And it brings down barriers. Laughing is an unguarded moment. And so whether it's in a social situation or a business situation or a comedy club, if you can make them laugh, and it's a gift. I believe I was born funny, and funny thing happened all the way down the birth canal. And so it greases the wheels of interaction with other humans. They automatically see you differently than they did the moment before. I'm in the airport. There's a mechanical problem, a delay. Everybody at the gate is cranky. They're upset. They're going to miss the wedding or whatever. And so, grumble. I'm standing under a television. And on the television above me is CNN. And pretty much everybody can hear the broadcaster. And the guy standing next to me goes, hey, how do we get this TV turned to Fox News? And I said, you kill me first. Everybody in the gate is laughing. They're still upset the plane's not leaving, but it changed the mood at the gate like that. And now, oh, and when I came to Eugene, I knew one person. It was the woman I bought insurance from on the rental house we owned in Eugene.
Okay.
So I called her and she goes, Frank, you need to go to this, they call it greeters. It's a committee of the chamber, greeters. You need to go to greet. My husband's big in greeters. He'll hold your hand. And so they meet in the morning for breakfast. And her husband introduced me around, and we're all sitting there. And just by chance, The person who was supposed to speak, because they always have a speaker at the meeting, didn't show up. So I said, how about some comedy? And Kelly, who was the co-chair of the committee at the time, told me later, I'm thinking to myself, okay, it's Springfield, Oregon. How funny can he be? So they let me get up on a chair. So I did it theatering around. And I've been doing comedy by this point for, I don't know, 25 years. And when I've been listening, which I think is important in networking, I've been listening to, as people, you go around the room and they introduce themselves. They give the name of the business, or tagline. So I knew there was a mortician there, a travel agent there, and several other occupations. And I had jokes for each one in my repertoire. So I stood up and I did 15 minutes, 20 minutes of just, and they're going nuts. So, from not knowing anyone, all of a sudden, every one of those 60 people at the meeting knows who I am and that I'm funny. Well, get this. The next week, the same thing happened. The speaker didn't show. So I said, how about some comedy? And Kelly said, we could do comedy or we give 10 people, members, 2 minutes each to talk about their business. What do you guys want to do? And they all screamed, comedy. I got up again. And that's how I became known in Springfield with all those business people instantly.
Yep, comedy always seems to work the best. I too believe in comedy. I sprinkle it into whatever talks that I have because it keeps everybody involved. You have everybody's attention. That's just one of the ways. But I truly believe it's very important. What business professionals learn from comedians about building rapport and engaging in the audience and
In
audience?
comedy, A, you have to read the room.
Absolutely.
During the recession, all my bucket list was being a police officer. I was 52 years old, and I thought I was too old, but I met somebody in one of the departments who said, Frank, there's no age limit. They can't do that. You pass the law enforcement physical fitness test, they have to at least consider you for hire. So I started training. And I apply with 12 different departments. And I passed the physical fitness test four times. Oldest person in the state of Washington ever passed. And at one of the oral boards, they said, look, what's the connection between comedy and being a police officer? And I said, we're both paid observers. A comedian has to read the room. Police officers, they pull up on a scene, maybe it's a like a gathering at an intersection, and they have to take the temperature of the situation. And I said, as in comedy, police work, whatever you say first can either, in police work especially, either escalate the problem or de-escalate the problem. So a comic will know, will read the room, read the intersection, and probably figure out who's in charge of this, who are the leaders of this thing, and then what they need to say first to de-escalate. So in comedy, you've got about, I don't know, 30 seconds, a minute to get their attention and make them comfortable with the fact that you're funny. When I do ships, stand-up comedy on ships, the first 10 minutes, I do my bullets, my A material. I tell speakers and comics, open with a 10. Anything that's a 10, open with it. Anything that's a 10, close with it. In between those, that's where all the six, seven, eight, five, six, seven, eight pieces of business go. You need to open strong and close strong. So I do 10 minutes, and then I go. Then I do what they call audience work. I go to the audience. I've made the audience comfortable. They know I'm funny. They know I'm not talking to them just because I got nothing else to say. So I think it's you need to focus on that opening. And a friend of mine wrote a book. It's called Finding the Funny Fast, and it's not for comics. It's for people who find themselves at a podium or rostrum and they have to speak. And her idea is that you need to take in the environment and say something funny based on the environment. For example, when I'm in Vegas, oftentimes it seems like the conference room I'm working in is miles from my, my hotel room. So I get up there, I go, look, I'm sorry I'm a little late. I don't know about you guys, but my room is long way from here. I'll tell you how long it is. I got rolling luggage, I had to stop and rotate the tires. Now they've all experienced that. They're all probably far away from, or there's a little bottle of water in the room, and it's $5 for 10 ounces. So I go, you guys have a bottle of water in your room? It's $5. You know what that means? Here in Las Vegas, it's actually cheaper to drink the gasoline. Again, it's a what you're looking for is commonality, relatability. You want to relate to the audience, something that they can wrap their minds around, something that hopefully they've experienced. And again, it brings those barriers down. I guess the bottom line is you got about 60 seconds as a comic and as a speaker to get their attention. And because they've invested their time, they want you to be good, but they want to know that right away.
Good, good. And you're speaking right along the same lines as when I talk. I'm thinking about my talks and the way that you're describing it. And I'm just about there, but I'm already thinking about how I'm going to rearrange things because of what you just said. But that's for a story for another day. What's the best networking lesson you've learned from your journey in comedy, the speaking, and suicide prevention?
I think it's a lesson that I already knew, that giving value first without expectation of return,
Right.
and figuring out what you can do for somebody when you meet them, not worry about what they can do for you. And a friend of mine who sells radio in this town, I sold radio one summer for a Cumulus cluster of stations. Somebody had asked her, somebody new at their station in sales, asked her about how to succeed in sales. And she said, don't sell anything for the first 3 months. Just show up. In other words, just go to the Springfield Chamber meeting, the Eugene Chamber meeting, the Eugene Chamber after hours. Just keep showing up, not selling a thing. Just have a presence in the community for 3 months. Don't sell a thing. Don't pitch anything. Just show up. And I think that's good advice. I think they're young, they're excited, they want to make the sales and whatever. But and listen, when I sold radio, the average salesperson in the company had a 20% close rate. My close rate when they fired me was 94%. Because what I did was, which most radio people don't do, I took what they call a spec spot out to every closing appointment. In other words, I actually wrote, produced, and voiced a commercial for that client. And the way I did that was when I met the client, I listened. Oftentimes, they would tell me exactly what should be in that ad. I went to an auto repair shop. Guy's name is Bob, still friends to this day. I go, Bob, tell me about the repair shop. They said, we're not the home of the 1999 oil change. Hold on. I wrote that down. Which in radio, they call a disqualifier. You want to disqualify the people you don't want to come, you want to qualify the people you want. I go, what are you the home of? We're the home of the 24,000 mile, 20, see, 24 month, 24,000 mile nationwide warranty. Hold on. So that's how I wrote. They wrote the ads for me. One of there was a construction company that did remodels, kitchen and bath. And their thing was, look, if you're looking for, hang on, there's a cat down here. We have six cats, and this one wants to come up. Hold on. Honey, I'm working. Come here. Sweet pea, where are you? Pardon me. I gotta get a hold of the tail. Okay, there you go. Here we go. Yep. So they did remodeling, and their thing was, if you're looking for three bids like your dad told you to do, that's not. Their thing was, you bring us a budget and a dream, and we'll make it work. So the spot I wrote was, they're the one client that didn't buy from me. And I wrote some crackerjack spots for them. One of which was, bring, whatever the name of the construction company was. Yeah, what can I do for you? I'm looking for three bids. Click. And you could hear the click in the commercial. And then the phone rings again. You can hear the guy pick it up in the commercial. Yeah, hello, what can I do for you? Oh, we got cut off. I'm looking for three bids. We didn't get cut off. We don't do that. Click. It was hysterical, and they didn't buy it. But the point is, they wrote it for me. All I had to do was take dictation. The client, so I would say in networking, listening is much more important than talking.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. How do you approach networking in high stakes or emotionally challenging environments?
Comic.
Well,
Yeah.
here's your answer.
I come in wearing Kevlar and heavily armed. And again, it's like that thing at the airport where I was just waiting for an opening to break the tension. And the guy couldn't have been better opening. It was perfect. People say things, and if you're listening carefully, again, listening. I thought for the longest time, Michael, that everybody thought the way I did. That they all, when something happened, they saw the punchline, and I was just beating everybody to the punch. So one day at the grocery store, I decided to give it a road test if that was true. I don't know if you ever do this, but I like to look at the things that people in front of me are buying and the people behind me are buying on the belt. It's a guilty pleasure. And so the guy in front of me, he had a bag of frozen shrimp, a quart of motor oil. Now, it just so happened it was back in the day when that oil well blew up in the Gulf of Mexico. Remember that? Hundreds of thousands
Oh,
of gallons.
yeah,
Yeah, the
sure.
oil. So I'm looking at that shrimp and that oil, and I know what the punchline is, but I decide I'm just going to wait and see if anybody else, the cashier, that guy, the guy behind me, I waited. Nothing. So I said, dude, that's an interesting purchase there. That's frozen shrimp and motor oil. Are you going to serve those Louisiana style? The cashier bends over double. And she, when she gets back up, she goes, you should be a comedian. I get that a lot. So
Yes.
I realized, Michael, that not everybody thinks that way. Comedy is a great, it's an icebreaker. It levels the playing field. People all of a sudden are taking you know, they see you for instead of just a blur. Damn.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the best icebreaker. It's the best tension breaker. It's good in many different facets, but I am a true believer in the comedian because you wear all sorts of hats. You can diffuse many problems without even diffusing the problem. You can just be yourself and you can find funny things in just about everything. Just
Yes.
about everything.
And I think if you combine comedy and empathy, I read a
Yes.
book called The Like Factor. The Like Factor. And
Right.
one of the things he said was you should always open an email, especially if you're going to be turning somebody down or saying something that they don't want to hear. Open it with an empathetic statement. Listen, I understand how busy you are. I get that. And then go into whatever it is, or I understand your point of view. You can also do that in real life. And he said, here's an example. And this has happened to me many times. I'm standing at the rental car counter behind somebody, and the guy in front of me is just raking the poor rental agent over the coals. And so he said, in that case, what you do is you need to let them know, the rental agent, know you saw what happened, you understand what happened, and you're sympathizing or empathizing. So the way I do it is the guy screaming and yelling at the poor agent behind the counter. They stomp off. And I walk up and I go, hey, listen up. I've got a car rental. My name's Frank King. Here's my driver's license. And I go, listen, I just got one question for you. At what point during this transaction, do I get to yell at you? Now they're laughing. They know I know what just happened. I took note of it and I made them laugh. So it's if you combine empathy and humor like that, where you're being empathetic, but you're also being funny in the process, then I think that's very powerful.
Yeah, I still say you can find funny things or comedic value in just about everything that you do or it happens or but you have to make the decision whether you say something about it or not. Because I always see the comedic value. And so I find comedy in just about everything. My wife tells me to shut up all the time. Okay. So I know that feeling. I know the feeling, but it's what you have to put up with.
And by the
And you
way,
should, what?
oftentimes when I do that, I get the upgrade on the automobile or the
Yeah.
upgrade to the economy plus seat on the plane. Because you, it just, I remember I'd done that And the woman handed me keys, and it was a Spider. I can't remember what company makes the Spider. It was a Spider convertible.
Okay.
It's sheet metal and an 8-cylinder engine. It's dangerous, but it was not a mid-size basic. I go, "This Spider is a mid-size?" She goes, "It is today."
Yep. Always, I would say almost always works out in your favor.
Yeah.
Almost always. All right. Can you share a story where a simple conversation or connection led to an unexpected opportunity?
I think the key there, networking key, is again, is it make it about them? Ask leading questions. Because it may appear at first that there's nothing you can do for them. But if you ask leading questions, I'll give you an example. When I'm on a plane and I'm sitting next to somebody and we're going to have a conversation, I ask leading questions through the flight. Never talk about myself, what I do, why I'm there. And oftentimes at the end of, as we're coming in for a landing, they go, "You never said what you do." I said, "I'm a comedian." "You're not that funny." I said, "I'm off the clock. Get your checkbook out. We'll yuck it up." One of the leading questions I ask is, and this there's the this surprise comes at the end. The leading questions I asked is, if you ask a question about how somebody feels about something, I believe is a powerful question. If you ask about their emotional connection or whatever it is you're asking about, and one of the questions, I got to grab the cat again. It's like she forgot she was up here. The I ask, "What do you do for a living?" And I'm an attorney. And I go, "Do you enjoy that?" And if there's a pause, Michael, yeah, then I know they don't. So the woman sitting next to me, I said, "What do you do for a living?" She goes, "I set up booths at exhibit halls for conferences." I said, "Do you like that?" Pause. "Yeah, it's not a bad job." I go, "Well, here's the deal. What if I go wave a magic wand and you could do anything you wanted?" I said, "Did your husband have a job? Good pay?" "Yeah." "If you quit tomorrow, would you guys survive?" "Oh, yeah." "So if I could wave a magic wand, you could make money doing anything you want to do, what would it be?" And I can't remember what she said. However, a year later, I got an email. "Frank, I sat next to you on a flight to wherever it was, and you asked me what would I do if I could do anything for a living." And she goes, "I'm doing it." So by just asking leading questions and especially ones that evoke an emotion. How do you feel about that? Do you enjoy that? And that was a surprise. I flew next to a pilot once. He was the head pilot for United Airlines or one of those. There were two airlines merging, so they had two head pilots. So somebody's gonna lose a job. He's on his way to Dallas to find out whether he was gonna take the job or not. Get the job. I go, "Man, what if the worst happens? And they blow you out, they pick the other guy. If you could do anything in the world you wanted, rather than being the head pilot for United, what would it be?" "Sous chef." "What?" He'd been a sous chef in college, and man, that was a surprise. And by the way, Michael, I just realized I've got a Zoom starting 2 minutes ago. Do you have another question before we go? Do you?
You know what? I do, but you know what? Let me just close it up by saying I can talk to you for another 2 hours. Okay. That's goes without saying. But if somebody wants to get hold of you, Frank, what's the best way that they can do it?
Oh, that's easy. Mentalhealthcomedian.com. Mentalhealthcomedian.com. That's my brand. That's my website. And all the information's there, email, phone number, calendar link.
Beautiful, Frank. Frank, I don't want to keep you from your next Zoom meeting, but it was a great, I had a great time talking to you, and I'm going to keep you in mind in case anybody needs that kind of help. I'm telling you, I'm going to send them your way.
Well, and may I close out the podcast the way a comic would do it?
Absolutely.
Okay. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe and tell your friends. If you did not enjoy this podcast, we hope you have no friends.
Thank you, Frank. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Well, hold on, folks. Don't go anywhere. Let me just read a few of our sponsors that we have. Struggling to reach success? Maybe it's time to quit. In Quit Your Way to Success by Rodney Davis, this reveals 27 steps to breaking bad habits that hold you back. This powerful book helps you rewire your mindset, take control of your actions, and turn setbacks into stepping stones. With real-life examples, motivational quotes, and actionable lessons, especially for sales professionals, you'll gain the tools to quit, what's stopping you, and start winning. Transform your future today. So Quit Your Way to Success by Rodney Davis, available now on Amazon. And this is a nonprofit called Revved Up Kids. This is something I believe in wholeheartedly. Revved Up Kids is on a mission to protect children and teens from sexual abuse, exploitation, and trafficking. They provide prevention training programs for children, teens, and adults. To learn more, go to revvedupkids.org. That's REVVEDUPKIDS.org. Well, that's a wrap, folks. A huge thank you to our special guest for sharing such incredible insights today. And of course, a big shout out to you, our amazing listeners, for tuning in and spending your time with us. Remember, networking isn't about being perfect. It's about being present. So take what you've learned today, get out there, and make some meaningful connections. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, leave us a review, and share it with someone who could use a little networking inspiration. Let's keep the conversation going. You can find me on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or my website, Michael. Remember, until next time, keep practicing, keep connecting, and keep building those relationships. This is Michael signing off. Take care and happy networking.